Okay, Shavuot Tov, Chodesh Tov, everybody's very welcome to, I'm very happy to welcome everybody to this particular session. Firstly, to explain who I am, and some of you may know who I am. Most of you, I guess, will be intrigued by my accent. That's usually the way it starts. My name is Ian Schaefer, it's my wife Machla. We've lived in America, as you can guess, I'm not born in Brooklyn, so not coming from that part of the world, but we've lived here nearly 20 years, 19 years, and we originally lived in North Jersey. I'm working in New York, two places. I work teaching at Yeshiva University in the Girls' School in Stern College, and I'm also involved, there's a very interesting kosher food program at Columbia University in the Barnard College there, which is also gives me a chance to interact with the students, see what's going on Columbia campus, which may come into the discussion at the end of what I'm going to talk about. Not quite as bad as Berkeley, but it has its moments. Probably had its moments and will continue to have its moments as well, which is, for me, a big eye-opener. Coming from London, it wasn't like that when I went to college, but I guess it wasn't like that when any of us went to college. So that's in terms of who I am and my background. You know, as you'll see, there may be a bit of British humour that may come into this a little bit, but hopefully not too much. But in terms of what we're talking about, we're talking about a very serious topic, the question of Zionism in the 21st century. I don't know whether I should close the door, leave the door open. I don't know if you might end up hearing from the other side. I'll leave for them. Okay.
All right. I'll make that.
Yeah, that's good. Excellent, thank you. Just care for your finger there. Okay. And the reason why I thought this was an interesting thing to talk about, particularly coming here at 10 o'clock at night, and it's after Shabbos, and, you know, we're all sort of, I suppose, chilled, but maybe tired. The topic is an interesting topic because it's something that I think goes to our neshamas. It goes to the heart, to the soul of every Jew. The connection, the important connection that we have in one way or another to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel, be it an emotional connection, be it a more direct connection, be it in terms of a family that's living there, be it in terms of relations, be it in terms of our support for whatever cause in Israel that we support. I mean, everyone has something where you can talk about your connection to Israel. Okay, what I really wanted to talk about, because I think discussing Zionism per se in 45 minutes is just not going to cut it, I wanted to talk specifically about the issue of religious Zionism, because I don't hear a lot of people talking about it. I hear a lot of people talking about generally the arguments for and against the existence of Israel. As I said, on Columbia campus, you've got a very strong Palestinian group over there representing that particular voice, and the Hillel is very active in terms of trying to advocate on behalf of Israel. But what we don't hear, or at least what I haven't heard in many of these discussions, is the original religious, let's call it, objections to Zionism, and has that sort of evolved and changed in the last 100 years. When we're talking about the origin of the Zionist movement, we're going back to 1896, we're going back to Theodor Herzl, we're going back to that whole interesting beginning of the Zionist movement, and again, I think the history is kind of well known. What happened, it didn't actually evolve in Eastern Europe, or it sort of certainly evolved in Eastern Europe, but it actually was happening in Switzerland, the first Zionist Congress, and, you know, all this sort of dates and history, I think, is something that maybe you've heard before. But what I think is not well known is the reaction of the religious world at that time, which was very significant in Eastern Europe and in Western Europe. Okay, it's not just the, sort of the Eastern European communities that we're aware of, where many of us probably where our roots are. My roots are in Poland, my roots are in Russia, you know, sort of that's sort of standard stuff. But also in the Western European community, maybe people whose roots come from Germany, come from France, there was a lot of opposition in the religious world to the concept of Zionism. And the question is why? What was this all about? And what I think is so interesting for me, and it kind of gets sort of people's blood pressure going, is you go to the Israel Parade. All right, we've all done that. And you have that little group of guys that sort of, you know, not in fancy dress, they're looking as if they're kind of Hasidic Jews. Are they Hasidim? I'm not really sure. And they're standing there with big placards every year, guaranteed they'll be there, the police protect them a little bit, and it's, you know, no to Zionism, Zionism is, you know, whatever they say. And a lot of people, it always amazes me every year how many people get upset about it, and people start going over to them and engaging them in conversation. It's very disturbing. I was once, I think, even in Washington, there was a big thing that happened, must have been 10 or 12 years ago, and it was that group was there. They seem to be everywhere when it comes to Israel, positive Israel demonstrations. There's always that group going in the opposite direction. And the question is, where are they coming from? Right? It's all very well and good saying they exist. It's all very well and good saying that they're around. They're there. But I'm trying to understand them because, again, they're Jews. They're also coming from a Jewish tradition, which we hope we all come from the same place, from the giving of the Torah, from what we call Masorah, from tradition. So why are they so going off in such a different direction to what everybody else is saying in terms of Israel, in terms of support for Israel? What is their rationale? Where is it coming from? And I go back to my yeshiva days, because it's interesting. I went to yeshiva in north of England in a place called Gateshead, which is similar to Lakewood, a similar type of institution. And one of the guys in my building, where I was staying, where I was lodging or whatever, dorming, was a Satmar Chosid. And he used to listen to tapes of his Rebbe, and the Satmar Rebbe was very famous. He'd survived the war, really miraculously, got out of Hungary in 1945, actually went to then Palestine, and left, and came to America, and essentially rebuilt his Hasidut. They were wiped out almost, I don't know how many left, a handful of people were left. And you go today and look in places like Monroe, and you go to Monty, New York, and you go to Williamsburg, and you see Satmar Chosid. It's like unbelievable regeneration that they've had. Unbelievable. And to their credit, they've been involved in tremendous projects. If you go to any hospital, I just heard about Kennedy, that they're putting in a room at Kennedy, a Shabbos room. And that is with the inspiration from an organization called Bikur Cholim. Bikur Cholim is a Satmar organization. They come from the Satmar Chosidim, and they want to make sure every Jew in hospital, either being visited or whatever, has an arrangement for Shabbat. It's an incredible thing that they do now, right, not only around this country, but I've heard about it in England and in Eretz Yisrael, obviously, but in other places as well. It's amazing. And yet, when it comes to the discussion about Israel, we're on totally different wavelengths. And Satmar is now considered not to be the most extreme. But in terms of what they represent, the Hasidut that they come from, what they would call the Hungarian tradition, they were certainly, once upon a time, the most vocal, vehement anti-Zionist that you could ever find. Nowadays, I would argue it's tapered a little bit. You've still got what they call the Turikata, which are right off the map. They're very much to the extreme. That's the group that appears at the Israel parade. It's not the Satmar. They don't bother with that because there's no point. But the small extreme group wants to be there. But I put them all to one side. I just want to understand, where are they coming from? What is their philosophy, if you want to call it that? And then what do we say? If we are coming from mainstream Jewish thought, if we are religious or if we are not religious, but we want to understand that Zionism binds us to Israel, what would be our response to what is essentially their arguments? And what do we say when they will confront us and call us, for want of a better word, traitor? They will say we are not kosher because we support the state of Israel. What are we going to say? And if you look in front of you, and this is really where the source material gets extremely interesting. I have a number of sources, and I don't want to overdo it, because, again, I'm not here to push too hard on the sources, and I apologize that two of the three sources, I couldn't find an English translation. I'll just paraphrase as much as I can of what I'm telling you. But the first source is a Talmudic source. And this is the one that every card-carrying religious Jew who still has issues with Zionism will tell you. And it's taken from the Talmud Ketubot. And the Talmud says the following, and again, if you got it here, you got it in the English as well. I'll read the Hebrew and explain, and you can follow with the English translation if the Hebrew, you're not comfortable with the Hebrew, or the Aramaic. Ahumi bo'elei l'chrabi Yosi b'rabi Chanin. There is a statement of the Talmud, which was based on the words of this very famous rabbi, Rabbi Yosi, the son of Rabbi Chanin. And this is Talmud, we're talking about 2000, sort of essentially, 1500 years ago, the period, the early period in the from the year zero, essentially, to the year 500, when Mishnah, followed by Talmud, was developed, and that's the kind of time frame that we're looking at for this statement, probably in the middle of that time frame. So he said the following, to Omar, Gil Shavuot Halalu Lama. There were three oaths, and this is based, as you'll see in the English translation, on a verse in the Song of Songs. Three oaths that were made, and what were the three oaths? Essentially, oaths that were made, meaning binding the Jewish people by God to the Jewish people. This is the way this piece of Talmud is understood, that the Jews would have committed themselves not to do, it's not just the Jews, but essentially applies to the Jewish existence, not to do certain things. Now listen to this. It says, Achas, the end of the first line, Shelo Yalu Yisrael b'choma, that the Jews should not go up b'choma on the wall. What does that mean? So I brought here the commentary underneath the English translation. Rashi says, famous commentary of Rashi on the Talmud. He says, Shelo Yalu b'choma yachad b'yad chazaka. The Jews should not go up to Eretz Israel by force. Very interesting. So according to this statement in the Talmud, there is clearly it's more than that, it's a commitment not to go back to Eretz Israel and force our way back into Israel. Now, how you understand force and how you understand what that means, obviously, it's saying, you know, we should wait in the exile, in the galut, in the diaspora, till circumstances happen which facilitate us to go, but we don't push the envelope. That's basically the way this piece of Talmud is understood. Interestingly, there are two other promises or oaths that were made. And listen to this. The achat, the second one, because you've got to take them all together. Shehishbia Kodesh Baruch Hu Yisrael, God made the Jews swear, made the Jews make an oath, Shelo yimradu b'umot olam. They should not rebel against the nations of the world. Wow. And again, what does that mean? Presumably in the same context as not going up by force to Israel, that would involve a rebellion against the nations amongst which we are living, in the diaspora. Don't rebel against them by going back to Israel in a forceful way. That seems to be what it's saying. And the third one, V'achad she'eshpia Kodesh Baruch Hu d'avdei ha'kochavim, in case you were wondering, that it was only us. No, God made the non-Jews promise, and this is one which I think we'll understand is kind of difficult. Shelo yishtabdu behem Yisrael yoter midai, they should not persecute the Jews more than necessary. Whoa. Okay, now that's something which is all well and good to be said 2,000 years ago, you come back with the benefit of hindsight, you realize this is something which hasn't worked quite the way it was meant to be. What an interesting statement of the Talmud. And the rabbis come along and say, look, we're looking at this and we take it as a package, three oaths. And we say to ourselves that these three oaths go together and clearly, and I'm telling you, this is really the source for the attitude which is prevalent even to this day. You know, when you're next on the...
We didn't go up by force, so
well,
why?
That's the point, but we'll come to that in a second. Just hang on a second, because what is the consideration today is that with Tzahal and everything that's going on, that's the definition of doing something by force. Originally, when we went, it wasn't. No, you're right. You're right. Yeah. Hang on a second, because that's an interesting thing. I'll take questions in a second, but listen to that. I just wanted to sort of get to the point here. And if you ask the card-carrying anti-Zionists today from the religious world why they are anti-Israel, they will say Gimel Shavuos. They'll tell you three oaths, and they'll expect you to know what they're talking about. So now we're, I hope, more educated in essentially in where they're coming from. That there were three promises or commitments that were made by God towards the Jewish people to say that one of them, or two of them, affecting the kind of situation of going back to Israel, not rebelling against the people around us, and at the same time making the non-Jews commit not to oppress us.
I always thought it was about Mashiach.
Sorry? Yeah, well, obviously what it leads to is to say, well, if we're not going to go back until such time as, you know, we're able to, then Mashiach is part of that equation. All right? When will the time be right? When will the non-Jews stop oppressing us? And this is one of the definitions of the messianic period. If you heard the rabbis just now, they talked about it. Mashiach is when the non-Jews stop oppressing the Jewish people. The Jews can live in peace. Okay, until that time happens, and it's kind of, yeah, you know, that's what they call in Yiddish Mashiach Zeit, because that's, until then, we know that it's not quite the way it is. It's depressing beyond belief, the news of, you know, we come from Europe. I've lived with issues of anti-Semitism in Europe. We came from England. I was so shocked how unaffected the American Jewish community was by this. Right, coming here, my shul always had security, always had schools, had guards, gates. This is now for like 20, 25 years in England. And coming to America was a big shock to me that this was not the case over here. And I was glad about that till last week. And I see already, you know, tombstones being turned over and all that stuff happening here. It's very worrying. It's disturbing because, you know, it's part of a bigger picture, which, again, I'm not really going to go into now, but it's unfortunately happening. We haven't quite got to the stage where they're going to stop making trouble for us. That's not happening. But what I'm trying to say over here, and we'll come to the sort of the more up-to-date stuff in a minute, but what this statement in Talmud, if we take it as a package deal, that all of these three things go together, we can see quite clearly that you can argue, well, look, if we are not in a situation where we can say, you know, that the non-Jews are not stopped oppressing us or something like that, it's not happening, then maybe these three O's, these three commitments don't apply. If you take them as a package deal. Yeah?
I think you have to understand this, these Amorim had the Bar Kokhba revolt, and Yochanan Ben Zakkai went to General Vespasian and says, let me build a yeshiva in Yavne.
Yavne,
transferred from Judaism to rabbinical Judaism.
Yeah.
So these guys in the Tamarim were, at that time, we pay our taxes, let us have our yeshiva.
Keep your head up.
And the Bar Kokhba revolt, that didn't work out.
Yeah.
And that, so from their perspective, living as, you know, subjects to the Roman Empire, that they were, you know, just like the other provinces of Rome.
Yeah.
As long as you paid your taxes and you didn't interfere too much, then leave your culture and your practices more or less alone.
Leave them alone. And that's essentially what happened.
Maybe that's why that was true for them,
but
wouldn't be true for
True for us. There's so much rabbinical discussion about this statement in Talmud, and one of the points is made is your point. There's a very famous rabbi called the Avnei Nezer. He was a very great man in the early 20th century in Poland. And his argument was very simple. His argument was, and he was around during the Balfour Declaration in 1917, right, which gave the promise of Lord Balfour to Baron Rothschild at the time that the Jewish people were being promised a homeland in Eretz Israel, which is probably the most miraculous thing in the whole of the 20th century regarding the build-up to the State of Israel, because nobody expected that to happen. And we're going to talk about Rav Kook, and there's a whole connection with Rabbi Kook, which is again, not by chance, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And he writes already that these three O's don't apply anymore. Because the fact that we now have permission to go up to Eretz Israel, we've been given by Lord Balfour, the British government, to take hold of the land of Israel, that already takes away the idea of going by force. Right? It's no longer by force, because they've given us permission to go. So therefore, and that was the whole sort of beginning of the first Aliyah, the original, second Aliyah, you know, all the different stages, if you learn the sort of classic Zionist history of the waves of Jews that came during the 20s and the 30s till the British turned around and said, Ad Kan, they stopped it. All right? I'm not a great supporter of what the British did. Oh, I don't want to go there because it's a very touchy subject. I worked with a gentleman once many years ago who was a British soldier in Netanya. And I remember when I was living in England still, and he couldn't understand how could the Israelis elect Menachem Begin, a terrorist, to become the Prime Minister. That was his comment to me. And he never spoke politics, he never spoke anything, but that he had to make a comment to me. And I understand that, you know, some of them went through different situations over there. It's complicated. What happened with the British is very complicated and probably needs more analysis. But again, I want to stay to the script. We're talking about the religious reaction, as it were, to this particular statement in Talmud, which is still the fundamental philosophy of the anti-Zionist group, right? Again, if you have the wherewithal to talk to one of these guys at the next Israel parade and ask them about this Gemara, they'll all tell you, they all know it. They'll all tell you, or some of them hopefully will be able to say it, you know, verbatim or whatever. And they'll say that, as far as they're concerned, this is the way it's been established, and it's not going to change till Mashiach. That's their comment. But as far as we can see, look, we can understand that circumstances will have an influence. As you said, historical circumstance of the rebellion of Bar Kokhba and all that whole thing then. And obviously in the 20th century, with Jews being allowed, given the permission to go back and develop, eventually, to build and to establish a Jewish state. That, is, in a way, does away with
the
three oaths.
The permission of the nations when there was the vote at the UN.
And the vote at the UN, which also came along later on, November
1947.
And
so that cancels the second.
Cancels it out. And all of this is, exactly. So what I'm trying to sort of put over here is that as much as this statement in Talmud is very clear, it's also crystal clear to me that nowadays we have moved on. And in fact, although this was a statement made at a certain time, we have gone on from there to a more practical situation nowadays, and thank God for that, really. You know, in terms of the difference between the world that I am growing up in, or my kids are growing up in, and my grandchildren, and the world that my grandparents grew up in, is that we have a state of Israel. And they lived in a reality where there was not a state of Israel. And boy, there's a big difference between the two situations. It's like day and night. It really is. Something to think about. The people that I want to focus on in the religious world, because not everybody took this as a negative. There was, essentially, I suppose you would call it apathy, bordering on extreme disconnect from the whole Zionist enterprise in the religious world, certainly around the beginning of the 20th century. But there were some shining lights in the religious community who said, we can't accept that we're rejecting this because this is something unique. It's something special. It's something that is happening in the Jewish world, which is so amazing. We've got to be part of it. And what happened was, there was a rabbi who, again, if you haven't heard of him, now you have. Somebody called Rabbi Cook. Rabbi Cook, what was his first name? Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Very, very amazing gentleman. A little bit of sort of two-minute biography. He was born in Lithuania, studied in the classic Lithuanian yeshivot of Volozhin, and, you know, was really one of the shining lights of the yeshiva. A genius. He had this burning love, desire, connection to Eretz Israel, came from his family connections, etc. And he made what we would nowadays call Aliyah. In those days, I don't know what you called it, because it was going essentially into the desert. He went to live in Jaffa in the early 20th century, became the chief rabbi there in Jaffa, right? Which now is interesting, because Jaffa is always considered a bit more an Arab population there than the Jewish population, but that was the Jewish town, even before Tel Aviv really came about. In the First World War, and this is why I want to tell you a little bit of the history, he was out of Israel, out of Palestine, collecting money for the yeshiva, whatever it was, maybe I think it was at the time, wanted to establish his yeshiva, and he went to Switzerland in 1914. And in 1914, the First World War breaks out, and he's stuck in Switzerland, he can't move. And in 1916, he gets an offer in London from the community known as Machzikei Hadas, which was one of the big shuls in London at the time, to come to London and be their rabbi. And he accepted the offer. He was, you know, obviously still in contact with what was going on in Israel, but he couldn't get back. It was the First World War, and it was impossible to travel. So he came to London, and for those 3 years, he was in London, and of course, 1916 is around the time, 1917, the Balfour Declaration. And the incredible thing about Rav Cook is, to me, two things. Number one, he spoke English, because he went to the government pulled him in. When the Balfour Declaration was being formulated, he was one of the advisors, because they realized this rabbi is first-hand evidence of what's going on in Palestine from the Jewish perspective. We've got to call him in. And not only that, but he was such an advocate for the Zionist movement and for everything that was going on, that I think he must have wowed them. My grandfather was a member of that shul. I never knew my grandfather, but I've heard stories about Rav Cook. It says that when he used to walk to shul on Shabbat, he had a police escort. And why did he have a police escort? Not for protection from people trying to sort of take a shot at him, but because so many non-Jews came out to see him. Because the man was such a royal, regal person. He used to wear, you know, his Shabbat fine clothes, and he used to wear a fur hat like a strimal. And people would just come to see him because he radiated. There was a radiance about him. Something I can't explain. And I've heard this from people, you know, from different sources, that that's what happened. The police, he had a police escort to sort of just keep the crowds away. unbelievable. And he was a remarkable advocate for the Zionist movement, and he got a lot of flack for it. And what was the big issue? And again, something which I think many people know, what was one of the practical objections? That most of the early Zionists were not religious. People came and they went to the different kibbutzim and they went to all these different places and they were not observant people. And bringing non-religious people into Eretz Yisrael was considered by many to be anathema. It was considered to be terrible. Rav Kook said no. Rav Kook's attitude was, you know what? Everybody has his or her mitzvah to fulfill. Sometimes it's many, if you're lucky enough to be able to have a lifestyle where you fulfill a lot of commandments. Some people, maybe not. But they'll have one mitzvah which they do very well. For these people, it was building Eretz Yisrael. He saw it as such a positive thing. It was incredible. And Rav Kook got it, believe me, to this day, there are people who don't even want to mention his name because of his philosophy. But thank God, in Israel today, there are many thousands, probably, I would say, hundreds of thousands of people who study his writings and have studied his yeshiva. His yeshiva is one of the biggest yeshivot in Israel today. And it is a remarkable institution. And there's no question about it, this man was amazing. And I just want to read you a little bit here. I'll read from the Hebrew here on the front pages from his letters. Fascinating, because if you want to get to know about Rav Kook, you've got to read his letters. This is what it's all about. And he says like this. He says, he's writing to someone who wrote him a letter saying, Rav Kook, how can you support the Zionists? They're irreligious. So he said that the fact that you are mecharpeni is a very horrible word. He says, in fact, you're mocking me. With all due respect, he says, shenaseiti le'etzik nuti zionist, that I've become a Zionist, la'akrim et nishmati b'shvil yishuv et Yisrael, and I'm giving my soul for the sake of the yishuv, of people living in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel. And look at the language that he uses. This is a critic writing to him. Ahuvi, he says, my beloved, my friend, he says, in kol ha-tzionistim, yiyu ahavim et Eretz Yisrael, if all the Zionists would love Israel, v'rotzim b'yishuv et arsen ha-kadosh, and would want to live in Israel, b'zot ha-kavana matara kadosha, with the same holy purpose, she'ani mitkaven elav, that I intend, b'shvil shehi Eretz Hashem, because I recognize this is the land of God, she'bachar b'Hashem itbarach, chivat kolam kolam, God gave us, the land of Israel, and chose us, etc. V'yesh ba segulot kedusha l'nevuah, it's a place of prophecy, and ashrad ruach hakodesh, and Holy Spirit, and all the rest of it, all the things that we know. U'lezakot l'idei licha b'olam haba, going in Israel gets you to the world to come, there's a promise. V'afil ha'rasha'im magina zechuta, and even protects the ones who are not observant. Rav Kook said, halavai, all the Zionists will be like me. He says, you want to accuse me of being a Zionist? I admit, he put up his hand and said, I am, and I wish they were all like me. In other words, with the burning desire, the love of connecting to Eretz Yisrael. This is a man who exuded in every writing, in every letter, in everything that he wrote, this intense love, this intense feeling towards Eretz Yisrael. He died in 1935. So he never saw the state of Israel, but he became recognized. He got back to Israel, I think, 1921, if I'm not mistaken. And the British, at the time, needed a chief rabbi of Palestine, and he was the obvious candidate. Why I talk about him with such reverence is because of what he did in 1925. He had his yeshiva, yeah, I expect. You know, as a rabbi, he had a yeshiva. He had a school. But what he did in 1925 is unbelievable. You can go home, put on your computer, look on YouTube, type in Rabbi Kook, 1925. What will come up is a picture of him at the Hebrew University dedication, the day they opened the college, or the day that I think they started building the Hebrew University. He's sitting on the dais there with Chaim Weizmann. He's sitting there with whoever's representing the secular Zionist organizations of the time. He's sitting there with the British Lord Samuel, or whoever it was, who was in charge of the British mandate. Unbelievable. And in the middle of it all is Rabbi Kook. And he spoke. And you hear what he's saying to him. You think, what's he doing at a university? This is a man who's dedicated his life to Torah and to Torah studies and whatever. And he's at the university. He understood that for Israel to be a country, like all other countries which they were hoping it would become, to develop it into a country, it needs institutions which are beyond what we had as Jews in Eastern Europe. We have to have yeshiva, we have to have population that understands its Jewish obligation. But you also have to have a university. You have now, thank God, many universities. And he was there because his attitude was very simple. And Rabbi Lamb of Yeshiva University wrote about this. He wrote a beautiful essay about it. He said, Rabbi Cook never saw things as holy or profane. He saw things as holy or less holy. That was his attitude. Something is not quite holy yet, but it's on the way. Even if it's a college or a university, which essentially would be indulging in secular subjects and teaching history and math and sciences and whatever, but he saw this as a way of bringing holiness into the world. Unbelievable. And the way he wrote and the way he functioned, there's no question about it, he is an inspiration for anyone who wants to read his books. Thank God most of his stuff now is available in English. Some of it still stays in Hebrew. His Hebrew writing is very poetic. So your Hebrew has not just got to be good, it's got to be really good. It's very hard to read him in Hebrew. But his letters are certainly well worth reading. That's more down to earth. As you see here, he sort of talks a bit about, you know, how people were bugging him at the time, things that people were saying. Anyone who remembers him, anyone who had a connection with him, all talk about the fact they use the word tzaddik. That's the only word they use. And yet, you see the incredible love that he has for Israel. I just brought you a little sample of literally hundreds of pages that he wrote. He was an advocate, a religious advocate for Israel. Religious Zionism, essentially, in the extreme. Okay, that's one that maybe I think many of us might have heard of or should have heard of, but there's another one that probably you've never heard of. And that's Section C. And I'm talking here a little about religious Zionism because I want to, you know, give us a bit of a different perspective on this whole subject. Rabbi Yisachar Teichdahl, again, has anyone really ever heard of him? I doubt it. I hadn't heard of him until this was brought to my attention, I've got to say. And you see the picture of him, and he looks like a regular guy you'll meet, you know, Williamsburg today, whatever, with the whole, he's got very piercing eyes. What the story of this man is beyond belief. He came from the real deal, the Satmar tradition. He was born and bred in Hungary, came out of the whole anti-Zionist world that was being created at that time. And to say that he was part of it is an understatement. His books divide into two periods. He wrote, he was recognized, he was called a Gadol of Yisrael, he was one of the great rabbis of that generation in Hungary. And what happened with him was so interesting is that till the early 30s and sort of through the 1930s, he was very much card-carrying, what we would nowadays to call very much anti-Zionist, and that was his philosophy, along with other things. He started looking at the world in 1930s, particularly after 33, the rise of Nazism and Hitler and everything else, and he saw the Jewish world falling apart. He saw Jews being harassed, he read the papers, he saw what was going on in Germany, he saw that everything was beginning to, you know, unstick, everything was falling apart. Got to 1938, 39, and he's asking himself, Lama, why are we going through this? Why is this happening to us? We've been here 1,000 years, we're in Poland 1,000 years, we're in Hungary for I don't know how many years, you name it, wherever the Jews were living. Why? Why is this happening to us? And he begins soul searching. And in the book, which is now available in English, he writes about his trials, tribulations, how he had to travel around different places because he was on the run at certain times. The Nazis knew about him, they wanted to capture him. It's an unbelievable story. In 1943, he's holed up in a bunker in Budapest. And he's pining for Israel. He came to the conclusion that the philosophy to reject Eretz Israel was wrong. The philosophy to go against the whole Zionist enterprise of building Israel. We had a chance, he says, we had a chance to go. Thousands of religious Jews could have got visas. All right, it wasn't so easy. I know the whole practicality of it, but people just said, no, we're going to stay. It can't get worse than this. It can't be bad here. We're in Europe. We've been here 1,000 years. Nothing is going to sort of do, all right, we'll have the pogrom. We've always had pogroms. Nobody was prepared to even contemplate what could have happened. And for Rav Teichdahl, this was devastating. In 43, he sat down and wrote a book. Had no books with him. Everything was by heart. And you read this book, you can't believe it, because the man had such knowledge of the text. Everything that he wrote, Midrash and Gemara, everything. In the book, he writes the most incredible things. He says that we made a terrible mistake. We made a mistake.
Is this just Hungarian Jews? That
particularly Hungarian, but he's talking to Eastern European Jews.
Okay.
And he is saying we made a mistake. And I want to just read one paragraph, as I put on the back here. And again, I apologize, I didn't get hold of this till recently, so I didn't put it in the English. But I'll show you what he writes here. He's quoting from his Rebbe, the Unsdorfer Rebbe. The only reason why I know Unsdorf is a neighborhood in Jerusalem, which is called Unsdorf. So my guess is this was the Rebbe of the original neighborhood in Hungary. And he says like this, and again, when you read the book, it's so full of longing to be in Eretz Yisrael. He knows he's not going to make it. I mean, to make the story a bit sadder, he's taken away in 1944 to Auschwitz and he's killed. He doesn't survive. There were two sons, I think, that were saved, living in Israel today, who sort of perpetuated his teachings. His book was actually published in 1943 in Budapest. Unbelievable. And then it got lost. It got forgotten. It was republished in Israel in the 1980s. And it created a stir the first time round, and it created a bigger stir the second time round. I can tell I was in Israel at the time, and it was quite an amazing thing that this book had been found and republished. Let me tell you what he says. I'll just read a little bit from the paragraph over here, and tell you exactly what he's saying here. He says like this. He says, "Shamati mipi magide emet. I heard from people who tell the truth. Sheshamun pi kodesh shorabena kodesh meunzdov. My Rebbe of Unsdorf must have been a very great Hasidic leader. Bishnat yudchet misparam. He said it in 1918. Shamar bezeh aloshin. He said it in Yiddish. Now listen to this." He says, oi. In Yiddish, everyone knows what the word oi is, right? Okay, he says, oi. He said, ich seh das chas v'sholam. He says, I see that, God forbid, Yidden velen nicht kennen verbleiben do. Jews will not be able to stay here. Talking about the heartland of religious Jewry in Hungary and around. He says, in die Medinas, in these countries. So it's not just talking about Hungary, it's talking about probably Eastern Europe in general. This is a Rebbe, 1918. Und man wird müssen laufen, right? I think the word laufen, people know, we've got to run. Man wird nicht haben wie zu laufen, but we've got nowhere to run to. As I said, in my grandparents' day, there was no state of Israel. Where are we going to go? He says, verwas seht man nicht aus zu bauen, and this is what the Rebbe said, why don't they build more the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael? Build up the new state of Israel, be pre-state, the kibbutzim and everything that's going on in Israel at that time. And this is what the Rebbe said. And Rabbi Teichdahl writes and he says, halavai, that people were listening and nobody was listening. They didn't listen until it was too late. When it got to the point where we wanted to go, we couldn't go, it was way too late. Way too late. And he writes over here in such incredible terms about the fact that so many people could have had a chance of escaping, etc. One of the things that upset him so much was the fact that Jewish property, Jewish what he called Jewish property, but essentially property owned by Jews, was just became what we call in Hebrew hefker. Just they could take whatever they wanted. He said, "Why did this happen?" And in fact, the back end of that is happening at the moment. If you've seen the film The Woman of Gold, the whole thing with the painting, which is now on show in New York, that whole story and various other stories like that. The reality is that for him to see this type of affliction come upon the Jewish people was devastating. And he came and he said to to the people who were listening to him, at least he wrote it, right? There weren't many people around him, obviously, that were listening to him, but he wrote the book, and he writes in the book, and he says, we made a terrible mistake. I've had this discussion over and over again with different rabbis who don't want to say this. They don't even want to recognize that this book exists. I've really talked to a number of people about it. And it's upsetting, because the reality of it is, and I've spoken to other people who went through, managed to get to Palestine, and other people who survived, who were survivors from the Holocaust years, they were very, very extreme in their comments about their rabbinic leadership that said, stay put, do nothing, it will all go away. And Rav Teichdahl writes this, and he recognizes the mistake that the leadership made. Unbelievable. Now again, he's obviously in an extreme situation. He's holed up in a bunker in Budapest, and the way he writes about it, that this is not a normal situation he's in, but he's writing in a way which is so, I would call it level-headed, even though he's in such an extreme circumstance. And for me, he's an inspiration. And it's a book which, again, I just recommend because it's so powerful. You know, we like to read certain books which will change us, books that will have an influence on us. And this book he called in Hebrew, Em Habanim Smecha, the joyous mother of children. That was a phrase that the Talmud says refers to the land of Israel. And his book is literally a poem, a love poem to Israel. You had Rabbi Cook, who was in Palestine from Eastern Europe, coming from the more what we would call Lithuanian part of the world. You have Rabbi Teichdahl coming very much from the Hasidic part of the world. These were inspirational people. These were people coming out of the religious world who did not accept that Zionism was anathema and something against tradition and everything else that unfortunately most of the people said. And to me, even though they've been gone for so many years, these rabbis, they are inspirations to this very day. You read their stuff and you understand that this yearning to be connected to Israel from the religious perspective, which is really what I wanted to talk about, is so deep, is so intense, is so powerful that nothing, I just can't put it into words. They put it into words, I can't put it into words. I look in the 21st century and I look in Israel. We lived in Israel for 8 years. We were made Aliyah in 1979. We left Israel in 86 and I went to become a rabbi in England. It's again, my story is kind of a byproduct maybe of a little bit of what we're talking about this evening, in the sense that we were very committed Zionists. I still am. I believe passionately in Israel, in what Israel represents, particularly from a religious point of view. I always argue the easiest thing is the hardest thing in Israel. The easiest thing is to walk around with a kippah. Nobody will even remotely... You know, I'm told now, certain places in London, certainly in Paris, you can't do this anymore. In Israel, Dafka, you know, you go there and you put on a kippah. If you don't wear a kippah in Cherry Hill, go to Israel, put on a kippah, because that's the place where you can wear it without anybody remotely sort of criticizing or having anything to say. But the trouble is, at the same time, it's one of the hardest places to wear a kippah because of the issues of religion and state that goes on there. The religious part is... And this goes particularly for the Peardis who accepted the state of Israel, the Aguda, and those sort of to the right, for many years stayed out of the government. They didn't get involved with the government politics. They were essentially what we would call a pressure group, right? They were lobbyists. In the 1970s, late 70s and 80s, they started getting into the government. And when politics and religion gets mixed like that, it's a very bad mix. It's really not to be tried at any level whatsoever. And I'm sad about that, because in Israel today, as I said, the greatest potential is the Jewishness of Israel. The challenge is the Jewishness of Israel. As I put on the back of the page here, the challenge for the 21st century is not now whether the Zionist enterprise is, you know, against religious belief or not. I think majority of Jews, even the ones who maybe are very much to the right of the spectrum, do have more, how should we say, feeling for the state of Israel, that, you know, people will stay the prayer, they won't walk out anymore. When I was growing up, people would walk out of shul if they heard the prayer for the state of Israel. You know, I remember certain people saying that to me. Couldn't believe they would do that, but they did. Nowadays, I think that's maybe past. I don't think that's happening so much. But the challenge for the 21st century is people like Rabbi Teichdahl, people like Rabbi Cook, are they inspiring the country just to be a country for Jews or to be a Jewish country? And there's a big difference. If Jews can come there, yes, thank God, it's a place. But what sort of Jewishness are we making in Israel? What sort of level of Jewishness is the country going to have? And of course, this is a very big debate, very big discussion in terms of the different sort of representations from the Orthodox movements and the non-Orthodox movements. And I respect everybody's interest, and I'm glad that people are fighting over this. For one reason, when you're fighting over something like that, it means you have a stake in it. It means you're interested in it. And that's what I think is so powerful today. I've always been an optimist, and I feel that even though with all the opposition that Israel faces, I think that the incredible thing of what's going on in Israel is beyond belief. As a person connected to the campuses, particularly as I told you in Colombia, the BDS movement, which I just want to mention in passing, but I think we all need to be made aware of, is really for many people just another excuse to be anti-Semitic when you see some of what the stuff they're doing. The tragedy is so many Jews are getting sucked into this as well. Kids who have no Jewish education or background seem to be taken over by some of these ideals, and it's a big challenge on the campuses to get the message out there. Birthright, to me, is saving lives. one quick story. I have a student in Colombia who went on Birthright, had no Jewish background whatsoever. Birthright was, she said to me, was life-changing. I gave her a bit of encouragement to go, and she came back and she couldn't thank me enough. She's now studying graduate studies in Tel Aviv University. I asked if she's got an Israeli boyfriend. She had to admit she did, which was great. I'm very happy about that. And, you know, it's a reason for me going to Israel, but it's phenomenal.
I know a boy from Cherry Hill, only dated Shiksas, went on a Birthright, met a girl from that same trip. They got married and living in Tel Aviv.
Beautiful.
Isn't
and
it
that,
amazing?
And I'm not talking about people become religious. As an Orthodox rabbi, that's what I'm, part of what I do, but it's connecting to your heritage, connecting to who you are as a Jew. And that is something which, if you have any influence on anyone, the program won't be around forever. Birthright is not going to be around, I would say, maybe another 10 years if we're lucky, because the money's going to run out. It has to. You know, the philanthropists are not around forever. But the reality of it is, whoever you can encourage to go, ideally with some sort of program where they're going and visiting, not just spending time in the pubs in Tel Aviv, which some of them do, unfortunately, but even there, just to be in Israel, recognize the fact that this is a phenomenal country in the middle of the Wild East over there, if you want to call it that, and here you go, and everything's working, and it's not just an amazing country, it's beyond amazing. And that, I think, is so important in the 21st century. Get the message across, but where do we get our inspiration as Jews? Always from people who were luminaries. Be it from the ancient days, and I'm arguing here, this is why I wanted to present this, from the modern world. Rav Kook is still inspiring thousands of people every day, every week. Look online, you'll see enormous web pages devoted to his particular writings. And Rabbi Teichel also, people getting to know his writings, and these were amazing, amazing men. I would like to hope and pray that the inspiration that these men would give us will be something that we can take away from this discussion that we had this evening, and be more confirmed, more committed to whatever we can do for Israel to visit and to support and to do whatever we can, because I think we all agree that this is a gift for our generation, which I think now we're all probably understanding we can't take for granted. Once upon a time, I think when I was growing up, Israel was like, it was always going to be there. It was always going to be state of Israel. There's no discussion. We're now hearing, you know, all of the discussion, all the politics, whatever's going on with the president or whatever, but the reality of it is, Israel is still fighting for its own legitimacy, certainly in the face of the world around us. And we know who we're dealing with, an enemy who's saying, we want, what did they say last week in the demonstration in Colombia? There was a big Palestinian demonstration that Palestine should be from sea to sea, from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. We know what that means. And plus ça change, unfortunately, things are not really changing as quickly as we'd like it. There are hopes, there are glimmers, but we've got to be convincing ourselves. If we are passionate about it, then please God, it will survive, it will thrive, it will grow, it will become something even greater. I'll open for questions. Not a lot of time, I apologize. I got a bit carried away with this, but you can see I feel very strongly about this. Any one or two quick questions? We've had a few points from before. Yes, please.
It bothers me that Jews in the West Bank, not arguing about whether you keep the West Bank or not, but
right.
You know, these price tag folks, they really put a black eye on the Jews, and I think that whether the Jews live east or west of the security fence or whatever, you always need the IDF there.
Yeah.
Anyway. But
yeah.
The point is that do you have to go out of your way to, like, not that I like the Palestinians so much, but you have to go out of your way to go down to their level to, you know, mess up their mosque.
That's very disturbing, and
yeah,
there's, I mean, and you'll ask the majority of people living there that they would not dream of doing that. Unfortunately, we've got our hotheads as much as, maybe not, hopefully not as many as what we see on the Palestinian side, but we've also got some people very hard to control.
And you can use the UN to stop the...
The UN is a whole... We've got to come back for another session. The new UN ambassador, the American ambassador, I heard that speech was so phenomenal that she gave on behalf of Israel that I think that the Jewish organizations, I hope he's going to run for president. You know, they're already banking on her for the next presidential candidate, because she said things about Israel which had not been said in the UN in favor of Israel ever. If it has speeches you haven't seen in the last 2 weeks, again, go home, look at it, because she, I don't even remember her name, but what phenomenal speech she gave. I mean, I'm also very embarrassed about the vote against Israel recently. Unbelievable stuff. Thank you for listening. Again, I'm sorry, it's very late night. I tried to sort of give you something to keep awake for. Thank you so much. And Bezrat Hashem, we'll next limud together should be in Yerushalayim. That will be the right place for it to be. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.